This programming is sponsored by the Near Northwest Management District, located just off 290 and the 610 Loop, with a mixture of modern and mid-century homes providing families room to grow. More information at nnmd.org.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us. As we do our favorite thing, Brandon, talk a little politics. So much going on. Of course, the big news is the White House and Congress are in this battle over the Mueller report. Are they going to release? Are they not going to release?
It's like American Gladiators back day, right? You got to go through the gauntlet, right?
That's right. You got folks like Nancy Pelosi saying it's a constitutional crisis and all that. But we've got so much going on even before we get to it. Look, it's another day and another Democrat is going to get in to the 2020 race. We've got Dem 2020. The apocalypse is upon us. I have no idea what's going on here, but Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana, will be lucky number 22. What's going on here, Brandon? Wow. What do you see happening?
We are close to having as many candidates as the number of years, right? Like 2020. I think that when Biden got in, he closed the door behind him, right? Actually, John Lovett said this last week. I don't think that this is going to go anywhere. But like we said, I mean, there's value in putting a marker down, right, for maybe kind of future fundraising or a cabinet position or something like that. So I can see some value in it. But we're going to have a serious culling in midsummer, and I think we're going to probably get down to more like a manageable baker's dozen.
Well, I mean, look, here's my take on it. The reason you have this many people running in it is they fundamentally believe that the Democratic nominee is going to be president of the United States,
right?
Because they just see that the president is structurally weak. I would argue that it's increasingly looking, if you just look at the broad economic numbers, that may not be an assumption that's worth holding on to.
I agree.
That the president is in a lot stronger position just based on the macroeconomic numbers for re-election. And we've talked about this in the past. It really is a historical norm to have two-term presidents. But I also think, look, your front runners are both a combined 170 years of age. They are old as dirt, right? Are your two front runners? We're already seeing poll slippage for Sanders, and he's essentially being replaced in some of the polls by a combination of Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris as the number two candidate here. O'Rourke's suddenly coming back now, a lot more media attention. Mayor Pete is still Mayor Pete and still in the middle of his moment. So you've got a lot of opportunity here. You got a guy like Steve Bullock who's trying to, again, take this sort of centrist side of the equation if you see everyone moving left. So, you know, I don't know, maybe they see, you know, you get a little momentum coming out of Iowa, changes the whole dynamic.
Nope. I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think you've got a Carter scenario here. And we know, statistically speaking, the more people that run, the more it erodes the party's base and it sort of develops bad feelings and fractures the fundraising. So I think this is bad for the Democrats. But obviously, you can't sort of put a moratorium on people running for president, because if we could, we would have done that weeks ago. So we have less to talk about. But let's talk about another scandal, Jay. I want to get your take on this. Now, Casey's is a fixture for Iowans. You can get gas, you can get food, and you can get breakfast pizza. Beto O'Rourke ran into a little bit of a trouble because he was caught eating pizza, saying that it was a breakfast pizza. There's a very specific type of pizza they sell, but it turns out it wasn't actually the breakfast pizza. So he's gotten some pushback from Iowans. So Jay, will Pizzagate end up hurting Beto O'Rourke
Man,
in Iowa?
Yeah, you know, we've talked about sort of weird little anecdotal inside baseball stories. I cannot imagine, but you never know.
You never know.
You never know, right? I mean, there's all sorts of things, you know, that can derail a campaign.
Right.
Maybe this does. Pizzagate part 5.
Yeah, right.
I feel like there's a Pizzagate in almost every single campaign now.
Pizza's the uniform sort of political connector, right? Actually, O'Rourke in particular, though, is shifting positions a little bit on impeachment. So I think your point is good about him moving up. And I think that's in part because on things like climate change and impeaching the president, he's gravitated a little bit. So he's competing in the woke primary. And maybe that's going to be a benefit to him. But of course, I think Uncle Joe Biden is really setting the standard here. But hey, Jay, talk about setting records. Donald Trump got some pretty bad news this week, courtesy of the New York Times. It showed effectively that he lost upwards of $1.7 billion. That's B with a B, billion dollars over the course of about a decade. Is this going to have an effect on the election? And what's your sort of impression about what this means?
Well, I mean, famously, he was the long-running host of The Apprentice Show. You know, he wrote Art of the Deal. I think he probably would have been better off being the host of the biggest loser, Brandon, because that's what he is.
Put him on a scale with money.
Literally no one in American history has lost more money than a guy that essentially ran under the premise that he's a great businessman. By any objective measure, Donald Trump is a failure as a business person.
You know what? It strikes, I think, a really good note that the redemptive power of TV is absolute, right?
Absolutely right.
He was able to refashion his narrative, and that really convinced people that he was an actually legitimate and productive business person. But you know what? It's interesting. So some research came out this week that shows that although it's the case that on, say, approval generally, you see a partisan split, right? Democrats approve, Republicans, or Democrats don't approve, Republicans do approve. One of the things that these researchers did essentially was to tell people that, in fact, he was not as good a businessman as advertised, which a lot of people did not know, and that cut across partisan lines. And what they found was basically that when Republicans were given this information, it reduced their perception of his business acumen by a significant percentage between 6 and 10% and reduced the likelihood of them voting for him for president. So the narrative that he constructed was so good and so powerful, people just believed it. And it's really not true what we find now, but also that had a political effect on propping him up among Republicans. With that gone, it may be a problem.
And I think if he were running for the first time, it would be fine, and that it would certainly probably have a much more powerful effect. The number that I think people are much more interested in isn't the $1.17 billion in the red. It's the 3.6%, which is the current unemployment rate. It's the fact that the poverty rate is actually going down. Real wages are going up. We've got a massive ballooning deficit, no debating that. But by any objective measure, this is the strongest economy that we've had maybe in over a decade.
And that's a major predictor.
That is a major predictor of everything. I mean, you just simply can't deny the fact that if you use the old Reagan test, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? By any objective measure, the answer is an unequivocal yes.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of tax returns, Jay, the White House is still embattled over this question about whether or not to release the president's taxes. The Trump administration this week formally rejected demands from House Democrats to turn over the president's tax returns. Get this. So the Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, says that essentially the demands raise serious constitutional questions and that it doesn't serve a legitimate purpose for investigation. What is your take on the fight here and maybe the kind of bigger implications for, do people even care about the president's taxes?
No, I think you just raised the issue when we were talking about the previous point. It moves people's perception of him. Donald Trump's entire sort of political power has been predicated on A, he's a rich guy, and B, he's a great businessman. You're starting to see cracks in the armor. And I think what ends up happening is that they want to do as much as possible, insulate him from that. So they're going to do everything they can to prevent that happening. If you have tax returns that come out, we already know his sister, who really has an overlap with him when it comes to some of these tax-related issues, essentially had to resign a federal bench because of an investigation, because she's being accused of fraud. You can't have the president of the United States be in this position. And I think that's their argument. This is a political argument. They're not making a legal one, because legally they can't deny it. And the simple fact of the matter is they know that the president of the United States has bad, bad tax returns, and that would cripple them.
Yeah, and it's, for me, a separation of powers issue. It's ludicrous to have the White House claim what is and is not a legitimate legislative purpose. Congress has had such broad oversight since the 1920s and the Teapot Dome scandal when it's come to looking into the dealings of the White House. So they have broad investigatory capacity that needs to be respected. And of course, it's not. So that's really going to delve into some of the things we'll talk about in the deep, which is sort of how it is that this gets resolved. Likely it's going to be a court battle, but that's going to be something which for sure is not going to go away.
And, you know, this goes back to this larger issue of, right, the president feels besieged. And so he's gone so far as to kind of make the argument that his first 2 years have essentially been stolen from him, Brandon, and some have interpreted his comment, which, you know, again, take it with a grain of salt, that he's essentially arguing that he should be given kind of a mulligan on the first 2 years.
Right.
Right. And for those of you who don't play golf, that basically means a do-over.
He's going to do-over. Yeah.
He wants
so
a do-over.
The president retweeted a tweet from Jerry Falwell Jr., who's the president of Liberty University, saying basically that Trump should have 2 years added to his first term to pay for the time, quote, stolen, unquote, by this failed coup attempt. you don't get bonus time in the presidency. This is not like hockey, Jay. Just because you take a hard check or give a hard check doesn't mean you're going to be in the penalty box. You effectively have the time allotted. And all presidents have to deal with this scandal, right? It's not like the President Trump is alone. How you treat it and the way in which you navigate it is really critical to pushing through on your agenda. And the president, frankly, as we've said many times before, has been pretty bad at this, right? And there's a recipe to do it well, and he just hasn't. So I am of mind to say that he really has no one to blame but himself for like the 2 years that things didn't happen.
Yeah, by that standard, Bill Clinton would probably still be president right now.
Right. You get like an extra 12
years.
Yeah,
just keep adding on time because, you know, it doesn't quite count.
Right. That's funny. Well, so the president was in the news for another reason too. Jay, did you watch the Kentucky Derby?
I did, and it was one of the oddest, most peculiar endings of all time.
Yeah, so tell us what happened.
Yeah, the horse that we thought had won the race, didn't look like it was in doubt, ended up being disqualified, essentially for sort of illegally nudging out another horse. But the president had a really interesting interpretation of what this all meant.
Right, so he sent a tweet out that said that the Kentucky Derby decision was not a good one. He said it was a rough and tumble race on a wet and sloppy track, a beautiful thing. But basically he says that only in these days of political correctness could such an overturn occur. The best horse did not win the Kentucky Derby. By the way, he misspelled Kentucky on the first tweet, and he has so much time on his hands that he retweeted it spelling Kentucky properly. So I don't know what to make of this, Jay. I'm not a horse racing fan, although I do love bourbon, but the whole thing is just, I think, just completely prototypical of the Donald Trump presidency, right? More questions than answers.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to me because I think the president oftentimes will use these interesting sort of little cultural sort of zeitgeist moments and just trying to leap on whatever kind of value he wants put on there. So it doesn't matter what it is. Oh, you know, it's political correctness run amok.
Right.
I mean, and it's interesting because that he chimed in on something, because literally this is the one time of year that anybody cares about a horse race.
Horse races, right? Well, let's talk about some Texas issues. We had a bunch of mayor's races, some pretty interesting ones. Let's start with Dallas, Jay. And what happened there?
So, yeah, we had some interesting outcomes there. Dallas, well, you and I had talked about this earlier, and we had called kind of 50% right there. State Representative Eric Johnson from the Dallas area obviously was leading going into that runoff. He is the kind of the consensus favorite to win now. He's got a tremendous support from the business community along with folks in the African-American community, and I think has gotten some key endorsements now from a lot of Latino leaders. Rafael Anchia, the state rep, has also now endorsed him.
Former mayors Ron Kirk and Tom Leppert, Republican, Democrats.
So. Yeah, all with him. So they're really kind of converging with Eric Johnson. His opponent will be a current city council member, Scott Griggs, who I think is a strong candidate, but there's just too much in favor of Johnson. He's going to win there. The San Antonio race, Brandon, that was a really interesting outcome. We had talked about this before. Ron Nuremberg, who himself had an upset win against Ivy Taylor just 2 years ago, was now forced into a runoff. And the basis of his opponent is essentially a candidate that is backed almost entirely by the Firefighters Union.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because the potential ramifications for folks here in Houston looking at this race shouldn't be lost. That's a 2-point race.
Yeah, that's really close. On Dallas, one of the factors was that Eric Johnson raised and spent a lot of money, almost $500,000. In fact, the third place candidate, who was sort of a wild card, Lynn McBee, spent the second most and got a third place. So it's all about the money. It's all about the turnout. Jason Villalba actually did not do well at all in that race. A former member of the House of Representatives, a sort of moderate Republican. He did well in his district, but pretty much no place else. So I think you're right. I think that Johnson's got that pretty well sewed up. But turnout was really low. And in a turnout race where you're going to get less than 10% of registered voters come out, it's going to be hard to predict. San Antonio, I think you're exactly right. Nuremberg missed winning outright by about 1,300 votes. It was very close. But the fact that you had such a challenge on this issue, I think, was pretty important. But I want to throw a wild card into this, and that is the Chick-fil-A decision. So that Nuremberg got a lot of pushback from denying the Chick-fil-A to have a space at the airport. And so it could be that maybe some people were unhappy about that. At least some Republicans were kind of grumbling that maybe there was some chicken-related displeasure. So I thought that was pretty interesting. But I want to add actually one final note here, and that is in my hometown of Plano. The only reason this is important, other than, of course, it's Plano, which is important for me, but that Greg Abbott had endorsed candidates in two of those particular council races, and both of them have gone to a runoff. So I guess one question is whether or not the governor's got pull locally and whether or not that's going to be something which is persuasive to voters moving into the runoff.
Yeah, interesting there. For me, the big takeaway, and I want to sort of bring it back to what we're going to see in November potentially, is the mayor of Houston should not be resting on his laurels, because clearly there is a mood to kind of mix things up. And when you have low turnout races, we didn't really talk about that. These races were abysmal in terms of their turnout.
As much as
we talked about how powerful the sort of the interest level was in politics in the midterm elections, it's just not there in municipal elections. You had a much more traditional, older electorate, much smaller, you know, really defined issues. And I think you're 100% right on the Chick-fil-A question. You had a more conservative electorate, particularly in San Antonio. That could bode very poorly in Houston for the mayor. I think he's in for a dogfight there.
And you've got Bill King and Tony Busby hammering him daily on just everything. So I think that's going to catch up to him if they're not able to kind of get around it. Well, let's talk also about local politics. The legislature has been dealing with issues on school finance. They're close, I think, but there have been some hiccups. So, Jay, tell us what's going on in sort of school finance world.
Well, very quickly, what we've got sort of, we've had two competing bills that are increasingly looking more and more alike. The big difference, sort of the big differential points here are number one, are we going to start using STAR and or some other test to kind of give more money to some schools based on third grade reading proficiency? That's one piece. The other is, are we going to give a $5,000 bonus for all teachers and librarians across the state of Texas? The Senate says yes. The House says we're going to give $1,400 to everybody, not just teachers. It's an interesting back and forth because, again, we're talking about large sums of money, but we're going to be adding money into education. Both bills fund pre-K for the first time, fully statewide. Both bills raise and update funding formulas. So there's a lot of positives there. I think we're going to get something. Dennis Bonin announced his conferees for the committee, bipartisan. And so it'll be interesting to kind of see what you get. I think you'll probably get something. But this kind of gets us into the other problem of how do you pay for all this? And the governor, and because part and parcel with school finance was getting property taxes down. That was that other part. The governor, lieutenant governor, and speaker thought they had the answer, except they forgot to tell members of pretty much both parties.
Whoops. Yeah, I mean, I think that they're close on school finance. I think you're going to find a way to put that together, you know, in terms of how much money to give the teachers and the employees. That's probably an easy fix. I also think that there's enough property tax reform built into this that it's going to be comfortable for both Republicans and Democrats. In fact, both of these passed with significant bipartisan support. And Kirk Watson actually was one of the head of a working group in the Senate that looked at ways to be able to pull in extra revenue from non-taxed sources, or just to kind of dump different parts of taxes like the severance tax or oil and gas extraction tax into a fund to help fund public education. So there are ways to fix this and to generate revenue that aren't taxing. And so that's, I think, been a real positive point for a legislature that sometimes goes off track. The question, though, I think is a real sticking point, and that is the one you mentioned about the STAR test, right? Will they agree on whether or not to use specific tests and tie that to the funding? I think a lot of people are really concerned about this, right? You've got third graders determining like the course of public ed funding, and that's going to be the major sticking point, and maybe the only sticking point that can't be resolved. So we'll see how that turns out. One final, actually, just kind of quick note before we talk more about the tax swap, which was a disaster, is that the M&O tax, right? This is basically the maintenance tax. Yesterday, in a kind of very low-key way, the House voted to eliminate that. That's approximately a $58 billion source of money that will be phased out. They're going to look at it next year or next cycle, and then they're going to phase it out potentially if they don't go back and change it. So that would be a nuclear bomb in the middle of how public education is funded. So we'll see. But maybe one way to summarize this is with an F-bomb, Jay, because during this last week of students taking the STAR test, one student called teacher over and said, "I found a nasty word in a graffiti that's part of the test, some part of the language arts element of it." And it turned out that there was an F-bomb written in the graffiti. So maybe that summarizes it perfectly, right?
Yeah, well, that's certainly the view, I think, of many parents when it comes to right. the STAR exam itself. Right. The STAR is wildly unpopular. They try to deal with some of that by saying, well, in at least in the Senate's version of this combined bill, where they basically say, look, we're no longer be limited to the STAR test itself. You can use other tests to make that determination. So I would look to see, especially at the lower levels, probably move to more sort of literacy-based testing just to make sure kids are able to read by the end of third grade and leave kind of STAR as we know it, kind of make it more of a high school-based exam.
Yeah. Well, hey, we can read a balance sheet as well as anybody and also a vote sheet. And what kind of world are we in, Jay, where we've got Republicans who are voting in favor of a tax increase on the sales tax swap and Democrats voting no, right? What is going on with this tax swap issue, and why is it the case that it was even brought up in sort of 30 days ago in a session?
Well, I mean, look, if there's one thing you know in Texas is that people do not like having their taxes increased. And it shocks everyone, right? I mean, we talk a lot about just sort of the explosion in property taxes, but we have really high and regressive sales taxes. So the notion of swapping one tax for another has zero appeal. We know that increases it when you increase a sales tax, which is what the governor and lieutenant governor and the speaker had proposed, is a swap to reduce property taxes. Effectively, what you did is you shifted. It was a huge win for commercial property owners and a huge kick in the shorts for pretty much anyone who owned a home and or bought things at the store.
which is
pretty much every a lot, you know, live person.
Right.
And so it was a massive problem. They said that on a percentage basis, it would look like if you were making less than $200,000 a year, it would be something like a 15% tax increase when everything was measured out. More so if you were a renter. So you can already see the ramifications. These are ads that basically run themselves because anyone making less than $150,000 to $200,000 will see a net tax increase.
Right.
That is dynamite, nuclear explosion for Republicans that are already reeling in the state. They'll probably lose lots more. I think guys like Paul Bettencourt saw this, and he was the early Republican opposing this, telling him this is insane to do it this way. Looks like he was right.
He took a lot of flack, and so I think you're exactly right. What's interesting is that you had the Democrats basically kind of riding the herd on this to count no votes on this. So eventually they stripped out that part, the Senate did, but it's still in the House part, so everyone was sort of mad. It became a kind of House-Senate problem. But I think the real person to blame here is the governor, right? I mean, we've had governors in the past who have tried to kind of shoot big for these major tax reforms, and they've always missed the mark. The last two big times it's happened, it went for Governor Bush and Governor Perry, it's been a belly flop. And what happened here for Governor Abbott was that this was something that most Republicans didn't bargain for, and Democrats were kind of put off guard too, although it was an easier defense. So I'm surprised it happened. It was sprung kind of mid-session like a Hail Mary to have more greedy tax reform efforts, much more than the body was going to take on. So I really think that this was a kind of a strategic mistake from the governor, and it may end up being that it has very short-term effects, but long-term, I think they can solve it. It's DOA, but they can still do public finance of public ed, and I think they'll be okay with it. So, Jade, in other legislative news, passing your first bill is kind of a rite of passage for many members, right? Now, Jonathan Stickland, who is a member of the legislature from Bedford, from the North Texas area, who's gotten into some trouble in the past for being in online chat rooms and looking for marijuana smoking pals and some other very, I think, terrible comments about having, like, marital rape. He has been a bit of a thorn in the side of the legislature generally, both Republicans and Democrats, in the last 6 years he's been in. And after that full six-year period, he has passed his first bill, Jay. So he gets a golf clap. The bill was a bill to ban red light cameras. So
correct.
There's a sort of a undercurrent of people, including people in the Senate who have passed a companion measure that limits or reduces totally the number of red light cameras. Not all places have it. Some places like Houston have actually done away with it already. So what's your take on red light cameras? Do you think it's a good bill or not?
Well, you know, it's already been banned locally in many jurisdictions. There's a few that still have it. My general view of it is that that government as a whole is the last to kind of follow through with some of the innovations in technology. And it probably would make sense to have more red light cameras and generally more sort of CCTV related things, because then it lets police officers kind of focus on more dangerous crime. Mm-hmm. That said, we know it's pretty unpopular across the state. This is the equivalent of, again, voting for a tax cut. Jonathan, the fact that it took Jonathan Stickland over three sessions to pass his first bill, guys like John Rosenthal in Harris County passing it within like the first few days.
Right.
I mean, it just speaks to how poorly he's thought of by his colleagues on a relatively easy bill. But what I found interesting is right after this happens, he's decided to go mainstream. He has quit the Freedom Caucus.
Right. Been pretty impressive, right? Yeah, now they're down to 10 members after Jeff Leach left. But it's like Mickey Mouse leaving the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse, Jay. Like, he's an original member, right? He is the thorn in the side. So I'm surprised that this happened. But I guess that this is sort of the way that the Republican Party is gravitating, at least for now. We'll see how that comes back. But, you know, Stickland, congratulations. The first bill, he's kind of sitting at double bogey, right? You know, but hey, the Senate's got to measure. Abbott said they should pass it. It's going to go. It's going to become law.
Well, just in case we thought that Jonathan Stickland was actually becoming a normal person, we shouldn't forget the fact that he got into a ridiculous tirade on the floor where he decided to call vaccinations and vaccines sorcery.
Wow. Yes. He again, pushing back against people who more or less like suggest that it should be mandated. The vaccination issue has been a big one for the Freedom Caucus. So he's left the Freedom Caucus maybe on paper, but not in spirit.
Indeed, indeed. Well, Brandon, let's talk about the big issue of the day, the White House and this ongoing battle with Congress invoking executive privilege, all related to the Mueller report. The Mueller report, the report that very few have seen in its unredacted form, but will continue to dominate the headlines.
Yeah, but executive privilege is pretty broadly applied by courts, right? Typically, it's supposed to be the case that Congress and the president sort of unilaterally each sort of work out a deal to provide information. So there should be some release of information. But in the case of a complete stonewall, like the White House is doing, it's a different standard. I'm not sure the court would look favorably on the standard. When political machinations are in play, courts look more deeply. This blanket privilege is a real problem for the White House, because that's not something I think Congress wants to continue. And so they're going to possibly push back, even Republicans. But the power's in the delay, right?
Yeah, exactly. The power's in the delay. Actually, I think it works poorly for the president. You know, there's a weird irony in it. The immediate announcement is that the report essentially exonerates the president. Now the response is, well, we don't want to release a report that effectively exonerates us. Because I think, as most people suspect, there are elements in the report that cause grave concern for the president based on the investigation. Now, this was a special investigation dealing with the executive branch in particular, both President Trump and candidate Trump. The notion that they're going to invoke executive privilege to prevent something that was an investigation of the executive, I think, is going to strike the court as essentially sort of trying to stop an investigation. And so I think the courts will ultimately rule on the side. Now, you won't have a constitutional crisis unless the president decides, I'm not going to comply with what the courts say. I can't imagine they'll do that. I think the politics for the president are even worse. And what's happening is you're starting to see a shift on this. This just came out that Donald Trump Jr. was re-subpoenaed to appear before the Senate Intelligence Committee, effectively for contradicting some of the statements that were made and cited in his previous testimony that were contradicted in the Mueller report. So you got a lot of moving pieces here. I'm not sure if this is going to work for the president in the long run. I think he's in big trouble on this.
Yeah, and it's an institutional question. I think the Senate thinks that way, too. They don't want to have essentially the future Congresses have to deal with blanket refusals from the White House. So the White House went from a man-to-man to a full court press, right? So that is not the way that other White Houses have treated executive privilege. It's not unfettered, and the courts have not given complete jurisdiction for that to occur. So I don't think that you're going to see the courts be that favorable towards the president's arguments. But we'll see, right? Courts are sometimes unpredictable.
That's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our producer, Sophie Mall. Special kudos to our web and graphics team here at Houston Public Media. And finally, thanks to our audio executive privilege engineer, Todd Holslander.
I'm J.R.
And I'm Brandon Roddinghouse. We'll see you next week.